now listening to The Limitless, the podcast between. I'm Jason Horsey, and this week I'm talking to Alison Miller, retired psychologist, psychotherapist, about the Grey Faction's attempts to discredit the reality of organized ritual abuse. So let us begin then just with the initial impetus for this conversation, with this controversy, if I can call it that, around the Satanic Temple.
Yes.
Curious timing, because I had been looking into them recently, reluctantly, because of that documentary, Hail Satan. Not really looking into them, but just had my awareness had got, you know, caught by them again. And then somebody sent me an email about with a link to the Gizmodo article about you and the Satanic Temple. So then that was when I contacted you. So let's just, because listeners won't be familiar necessarily with any of that, so let's just go through exactly what happened from your end and your impressions of it, I guess, starting with, well, post-retirement. You retired in 2017 as a therapist, and when did begin with the, when did the Satanic Temple file their complaint?
It just was this summer, in the summer of 2019, I think, July, I got this, the College of Psychologists contacted me and said, we got a complaint from this particular person. It was just a name that I didn't recognize. But no wonder I didn't recognize him. I've never met him, and he lived a long way away.
Evan Anderson, is it?
Evan Anderson, that's right.
Yeah.
I didn't know who he was. I asked Neil Brick, who runs the SMART website as well as the survivorship group, and he told me that Evan Anderson was one of the Satanic Temple guys, part of the Grey Faction. So I investigated online and discovered he's the director of this thing called the Grey Faction of the Satanic Temple. He, in his complaint, it took a while for the college to send me the complaint, which was really quite long and detailed. And Anderson did not identify himself as being with the Grey Faction. He was just, you know, a concerned individual who believed that I was spreading false information and starting up the Satanic Panic of like the 1990s, and I was a irresponsible therapist, et cetera, et cetera.
Right.
So I got the complaint in July. The college gave me 2 weeks to respond, which was ridiculous because where I'm living, it takes a while for the mail even to get to me and back to them. Right. I asked for longer, but then I decided I would simply write the response and get it done. So it's just very recent that this thing happened. You know, I had an experience, Jason, about a year ago when I was walking with a little boy around and looking for birds' nests, and I picked up this thing which I thought might have a bird's nest in it. It was supposed to have one, and it had a hornet's nest. So I got stung. Fortunately, the little boy didn't get stung. But I'm beginning, I am kind of hoping that the Satanic Temple guys that I'm beginning a hornet's nest here, you know, because I was retired and I wasn't doing anything anymore in terms of, all these issues. And now all of a sudden it seems like they're going to accuse me of things. Well, I'm going to figure out who they are and what they're up to.
Hmm. I see. So you've been galvanized.
I've been kind of galvanized by this experience. That's right. I was busy being retired and then, yes.
Right. Well, that would be an ironic result, wouldn't it?
It would.
So I also feel a little galvanized by this, hence the conversation. Obviously, I haven't retired. I mean, I don't have a job to retire from, but I have been trying to focus less on this subject matter. I've been trying to kind of reorientate myself to more light-oriented subjects, and I won't say I haven't been succeeding. I have, but there's still obviously it's not either or. Anyway, so this has pulled me back in, and so I also feel. When I get wind of what the Satanic Temple are up to, I do feel a strong urge to confront it. And I wonder now, you know, if that might be part of their intention or not. It does make me wonder. But anyway, let's just stay on how it played out, because they're currently claiming that they have successfully exposed you and forced you to revoke your license, which you're saying is entirely false. They're creating their own spin around this, is that right?
Well, that's right. And they got this guy to write this Gizmodo article, which suggests that his title is very clever because it says, you know, that that I gave up my license after receiving a complaint from the Satanic Temple, which is technically true. I did give up my license after receiving the complaint, but not because of what they said about me. Not at all. What really happened was that they made this complaint. And in the complaint is basically a list of allegations that I have made in my published work and in my online videos about what organized sexual abuser groups do, including specifically satanic ones, which use a whole lot of satanic trappings as part of their abuse. Whether or not they're real believers in Satanism, they use a lot of this kind of thing to terrify and intimidate children. And so I made some allegations in these public situations, and basically what Anderson did was collect a whole lot of choose the more outlandish things that I referred to, which of course I only know about from clients telling me, from other therapists' work, from the Extreme Abuse Survey, from places like that. It's not like there is published material that documents open things about what these groups do, because what they do is in secret at night and is supposed to be completely kept secret. And so the only people who will talk about it are some very brave survivors of these abuses who have remembered some of it and are prepared to talk, but it's dangerous for them to do so. Basically, what they did was the Satanic Temple guys, specifically the Gray Faction, collected a whole bunch of this stuff and threw it at my licensing board, knowing that most licensing boards for mental health professionals don't know an awful lot about this stuff. How can they? They're just a bunch of regular, dedicated therapists, psychologists in my case, and they know what they know, but unless they have a member on their inquiry or those committees that actually knows about these things, this is all new information to them, and they read this and they remember all the stuff that was in the popular press in the 1990s when the False Memory Syndrome Foundation and other such groups were suggesting that therapists put this stuff into people's minds, and they say, "Oh my goodness, this is dreadful stuff. It couldn't possibly really happen." Now, they didn't actually respond that way. They just responded by saying that these allegations were unusual, and perhaps, you know, it would have been better for me to qualify my accusations, my accusations about what the perpetrator groups do by saying this is how I learned it. And of course, in my published writings, I do talk about this is how I learned it. But when I'm giving a little talk at a conference for survivors, I don't necessarily say that every time I mention something that groups do. I don't necessarily say, "Well, I learned it from a survivor or wherever I learned it."
Yeah.
It just doesn't work that way when you're giving a talk.
Well, particularly not if it's a talk for survivors who have every reason to believe or even know the truth of what you're saying. that's a difficult tightrope to walk, isn't it?
I
Because
think that's right. Whereas if I'm speaking at a professional conference, I will cite sources and that kind of thing. That's important. But when I'm talking for people who've come specifically to hear me talk to survivors, I don't necessarily constantly qualify my statements. But in any case, this is what they sent to the College of Psychologists. And the College of Psychologists looked at this, said, we don't know about this stuff, but she didn't cite her sources. If she were remaining an active participating member, we would need to caution her to be careful about saying why she's making this statement. Where did she get her information? So I'd be happy to do that if that were the case. But the fact is, I retired 2 years ago, and the only reason I retained my membership in the College of Psychologists, which costs me money, is because I had read the documents they had about non-practicing psychologists, which suggested to me, maybe I misread them or maybe they just weren't clear, which suggested to me that we have to, if we leave the membership in the College of Psychologists, we have to leave our client files with a person who is still a member. And I moved away from Victoria and without leaving my files behind, and couldn't find someone in my new location who knew me well enough and was prepared to hold on to my files. And therefore, I maintain my membership. So that this is why I was still a member, even though I had actually retired. So when I dialogued with the college, I wrote a written response to the College of Psychologists. Well, first of all, I should add something. The College of Psychologists looked at Anderson's complaint. Okay, there's that. And then they said, oh, look, she was making videos more recently when she's a non-practicing member. She's not allowed to make videos when she's a non-practicing member. Well, I didn't know that. Nobody had told me that. It told me it, they had said that. I figured that not practicing psychology meant you didn't do direct therapy. And also, I had stopped doing consultations and supervision and all of those things, thinking that, okay, I'm a non-practicing member, I won't do that stuff. But making a video in another country at a conference, I didn't think that was a problem. Giving a talk that happened to be videotaped or writing professional articles. So the college asked me, well, actually, what have you been doing professionally in the last 2 years? So I gave them a list of my publications and things, and they got that. And then I had a phone call from the registrar of the College of Psychologists saying, did you know that these things are considered professional activities, and as a non-practicing member, you're not allowed to do them? And I said, oh, I wasn't aware of that. I thought I just wasn't allowed to see clients or do supervision. And she said that. And she also said, why are you still a member when you're retired? And I said, well, I thought I had to be for the sake of my clinical records. And she said, no, you don't have to. As long as you have a psychologist somewhere else who is a member who knows where your records are, that's all you need to do. And so why do you don't need to maintain your membership? And I asked her, well, does this mean that I am then free, if I am not a member of the College of Psychologists, then I am free to give talks, make videos, and publish articles, and nobody has jurisdiction over that? And she said, that's right. You can do what you want when you're not a member, but when you're a member, we have to monitor you. And so I said, fine. And she said, well, if you resign, then you will be free from that restriction. And I thought, okay, there's no reason to maintain my membership.
This hasn't inconvenienced you then in any way at all.
No, not at all.
Right.
No, it hasn't done anything like that. So I was fine with that. I resigned because there was no reason to remain a member, and I didn't want to be violating the college's rules, which I mean, these rules are not, it's kind of stupid to ask retired members, for example, not to be able to do any teaching and writing when surely people want to hear from people who've practiced for a long time. But apparently, these rules were foisted on the College of Psychologists by the provincial government, and so they have to obey those rules and make us obey them too. So no, it hasn't inconvenienced me at all.
And what was your sense of the College of Psychologists' attitude to you and to this? Were they supportive, or were they? How do you feel that they were? How concerned were they?
I felt that they were doing their job and that they didn't really want to go into any more detail in investigating such a complaint. It's an unusual complaint. It's a complaint in an area that they probably don't know a great deal about. Most complaints are in the order, in the area of custody and access assessments, things like this that they are familiar with, and they weren't familiar with this. They didn't want to go to a great deal of trouble about this. And I had told them in my response who Evan Anderson was, that he was a member of this group whose mandate specifically is to find ways to attack therapists who are working with people who claim to be dissociative or claim to have memories of extreme childhood abuse. This is what they're trying, this is what they do. And so I think the college didn't really want to deal with it particularly. So if I quit, that would it would be just as convenient for them as it is for me.
Right, so not overly interested really, just having to go through the necessary procedure to satisfy the complainant. So the way that, of course, this has been spun by the Satanic Temple and this Gizmodo article, I don't know if it's, has it been reported on anywhere else?
I don't really know. I don't know where it's gone on the internet. I know that I found out about the Gizmo. I mean, I was satisfied it was okay. I hadn't even re received the college's response yet, but I had resigned and I was fine with all of that. And then the Gizmodo guy tried to contact me. He didn't have my contact information, but he contacted a colleague of mine in Victoria. Who runs Life Seminars, which is a parent education program that I started years ago, and she continues it. And he contacted her and asked if he could get in touch with me because he was writing an article about me. And I didn't know who he was, and didn't want, he wanted me to respond very quickly. And the next thing I knew, I was being contacted by Neil Brick of Survivorship saying it's all over the internet, it's all over Twitter that this article is there, and they're saying that they may, the Satanic Temple is saying that they made you resign, and this article makes it look like you were forced to resign because you do this discredited form of therapy. And I thought, this is absurd. Why are they doing this? No, I resigned because I retired and I'm happily doing other things now. And as you said about yourself, I'm trying to put positives into my life after working with a lot of negative stuff for a lot of years. And I got a little upset about it, angry that they should do this.
And do you think, I mean, you mentioned that the Satanic Temple got this guy to write the article. Was that just a figure of speech, or do you have any reason to think that they were using somebody in that
No,
way?
actually, I don't know. I don't know if they got him to write the article. I don't know where he got the idea. I don't have information about that. I would guess that they got him to. Because I have heard from other so another source that he is somebody who is part of the false memory movement and is has written other things about childhood abuse memories being false.
His name Ed Cara, something like that.
That's right.
Okay.
But I don't know anything more about him. I do know that the article was very cleverly worded to make it appear as though my resignation from the college was because this complaint was about to find me guilty of practicing bad therapy. But yeah.
Yeah, so it's possible that was the intention all along, to use you as an example, in order to generate more publicity in this regard.
Absolutely. Well, I should also say that there are a number of other therapists who have been targeted by this group, and most of them haven't talked about it, but I would guess that there are more. There's two that have talked about it. Neil Brick himself, who heads up survivorship, has had a complaint to his licensing board. He's written about it on his website. And Ellen Lacter, who practices in California, Ellen has also had a complaint that she's written about on her website. So they went after those two people. Essentially, I think this is their mandate, and what they wanted was one complaint that was validated. Neil's complaint did not get validated. Ellen's complaint did not get validated. And then, lo and behold, there's my complaint, and I have resigned. And so, oh boy, we've got a validated complaint, or we're going to pretend that we did anyway.
Right.
Because that's what they're looking for with every one of these. Their agenda, I think, is not just to harass us, but to make the world believe that we practice bad therapy. So anything they can do, to do that, they will.
And it extends much further into invalidating the method of the therapy and the understanding around trauma, memories of trauma being stored in the body, and because that's one of the ways that they try to discredit you was by taking some of what you'd said without the deeper context, as if to demonstrate that you were using a faulty therapeutic methodology.
That's right. Most of it was about my allegations about what perpetrator groups do, but there was some about therapy too. Like somehow my saying that memories are stored in the body became memories are stored in the body rather than the brain, which is not something I said.
It's not either or, right?
It's not either or. The body is represented in the brain, every part of the body. And a lot of survivors of abuse or various kinds of trauma experience bodily symptoms, which are actually part of memories, because a memory isn't just a movie of what happened visually or an auditory tape of what happened. It also includes the bodily sensations, and trauma has a lot of bodily sensations. And there are some very good experts. Bessel van der Kolk wrote The Body Keeps the Score. Pat Ogden, there's a number of people who've written about body memories, but somehow they're trying to distort things to make it appear that I have invented some kind of strange therapy. Well, I haven't. This is just something that all trauma therapists know.
And in fact, it's becoming much more prevalent, even in the last few years. This model for understanding trauma being stored in the body has gone viral almost. I mean, I'm encountering it everywhere.
Well, that's right. And survivors know what they're talking about because this is how it works. Yeah.
Well, I'd like to get into that a bit later because I think it's a big subject, but let's just stay on the Grey Faction for now. You mentioned you don't really know that much about them, and I don't either, but let's just talk about what you do know, what your impressions are, and what you've heard, and what you know about how they came about and what their mission is.
I went to their website. I didn't spend very long on there. I went to their website to look at what they do, and their mandate specifically is to target therapists. It says so. This is, if you have any concern about a therapist, please contact us, and we will help you do something about it. And specifically, they are concerned that we are promoting the false idea that people repress memories of childhood abuse and then these memories come up later. Well, first of all, it's dissociation rather than repression. Repression is like you shove something down that you consciously are aware of and then it pops up, it can be brought up later. Whereas dissociation means that in the first place, a trauma, especially in childhood, is so severe that it splits the brain circuitry, and you don't remember what happened because it's another part of you, or various other parts of you that experience that trauma. So that's it. That's different in the first place, and you don't remember it because that didn't happen. For example, just the day child and the night child. If you're being abused at night, say by a family member, And you don't know what happened, and you have to go to school, and you have to go to school not knowing what happened. And so the kid who goes to school doesn't know what happens at home at night. There's another part of the kid who knows what happens at home at night and doesn't go to school. And that way, the child isn't going to talk about what happened because they don't know. These perpetrator groups are aware of dissociation, and they utilize the knowledge of that happening.
Right. That example you just gave as well, there's two ways that would work, because you're saying it would be in the interests of the abusers so that the child doesn't talk about it, but it would also be in the interests of the child in order to be able to even go to school and handle the environment there to leave behind the intense trauma.
Well, that's right. And also, if the child's being abused by parents, for example, the child wants to be able to go to the breakfast table without, and have a relationship with those parents, which isn't all about the abuse and the trauma. When the child is stuck living with them, it's too much for a child to live and sit across the breakfast table from somebody who just raped her in the night.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So coming back to Grey Faction, then they're targeting therapists in order to discredit them. What are they actually doing in your experience?
Well, I only know what they did to me, which was a complaint to my nice licensing board, and that's what they did to Neil Brick and to Ellen Lechter. Ellen's was not, yeah, Ellen's was a very specific complaint about a specific client case. But both those people were exonerated. If I had followed through and remained a member, I wouldn't. What the College of Psychologists would have done is tell me to be cautious about my public statements. I think that's basically what they would have done. A little slap on the wrist, if you like, and that's fine. I can handle a slap on the wrist. I can be more cautious about public statements. No big deal.
Might even be good advice, in fact.
Yes, it might indeed.
Right.
That's right, and that's fine.
Is there any evidence? Because I think at the SMART, Stop Mind Control and Ritual Abuse website, Neil Brick's site, there's allegations there that the Grey Faction have also been, I don't know about harassing survivors, but but filming them, and is there
They
what's
have showed up at survivorship conferences. Yes, I have been at survivorship conferences where people like that showed up. They were taping, nobody was allowed to take sessions, and they were taping things. They used to show up at those things regularly, and when Neil was talking, flash hand signals at him, so he says. And I actually observed this, so Neil was very uncomfortable giving the talk because he, being a survivor himself, is, responds to those hand signals, and he would talk with his head down so that he wouldn't see certain members of the audience, because they were doing this. And I did see some of this happening. I didn't understand what the hand signals were or what they were supposed to accomplish, but they were showing up at conferences. At professional conferences, they would show up at the ISSTD, that's the International Society for the Study of Trauma and Dissociation. I saw them in the hallways giving little plays, and they were shouting out names of authorities in the field and saying, I don't even know exactly, I didn't stay around long enough to figure out what they were accusing these people of. My name wasn't on the list yet. Even though I had published books, they were kind of avoiding letting people know that I had written on the subject because they didn't want people to read my books, I guess. But they were shouting out names and accusing them of practicing bad therapy, recovered memory therapy. And they were doing little plays in the hallways. They were not invited to the conferences. They were not members. They just showed up. It was absurd, and it was childish.
And it says SmartSight as well, it mentions that they've been putting the f they've been showing the films that they've been making of survivors publicly, making them public. Is that true? Do you know?
I don't know. I would defer to Neil Brick in this.
Okay.
I'm not aware.
So, I mean, to be devil's advocate, sorry, it's probably a bit of a loaded phrase, isn't it?
Yeah.
But is there any way that is there any way to see that the Grey faction are sincerely concerned about people being, misled by therapists and that are, acting out of desire to help people? Is there any possibility of that, do you think?
I don't know. The people who run the Grey Faction do not, to my knowledge, have any professional credentials in the field of mental health or trauma. If they had, I'm sure they would announce those credentials, and they haven't done that. So why they even know this, who they are, I don't know. A few years ago, well, a couple of years ago, I guess, I don't know exactly when it was, but there was some online website where they were trashing me. It was a comparative religions website, and they were on the atheism section, and they were talking there. So I went on there and told them, under my own name, just to see what would happen, to dialogue with them. And they were talking like 10-year-old boys. Ha ha, you're mental, that kind of thing. It was really very strange. Just a bunch of guys sort of ganging up and making silly accusations. And I thought, these guys do not have any maturity, and they don't have any actual knowledge as far as I can see. Now, maybe they have some members that have some knowledge, but I haven't run into them.
Yeah, so they definitely don't give the impression of being serious and concerned people looking out for the public welfare.
That's right. And they're certainly not scholars.
Yeah, so I mean, it's very difficult for me to see them as anything besides a reasonably clever front for something else. And I mean, I'm very reluctant to talk to them. I mean, I got pulled into Lucian Greaves' Twitter feed a while ago. I can't even remember why, but something I'd written or something. And I just very quickly I just blocked all of them because I don't feel there's any sincerity there at all. So that's me, but I'm aware that of course that can be counterproductive and that can play into their hands. If I'm not careful, one has to try to stay open. But the front, the persona or the public image that they're trying to generate, my impression is it just doesn't really hold much water. They're trying to create the public image of a secular kind of statism that's a kind of high level prank in order to confront religious intolerance and oppression and ignorance. So they're using Satanism as a kind of a sort of joke and a way to provoke and you know, force people to question their values on the one hand, and on the other hand they're really trying to bring about changes, positive changes for people. And then specifically around the satanic ritual abuse, their angle is that the satanic panic, everybody knows it was all mass hysteria, and that dozens of people were, you know, convicted who were innocent, and so on and so forth. That narrative, which most people still believe, even though we have a book like Ross Chait's The Witch Hunt narrative, which thoroughly examines that and shows that it's simply not true. There was no satanic panic in the sense of mass hysteria. There was a lot of confusion, but essentially there was as much fire as there was smoke there. So, but they're depending on people's ignorance around that, and this residual belief that there was something called the satanic panic and it harmed a lot of innocent people and there were no abused children. Now, it just seems very difficult what they're trying to do, because in our current climate, we're more and more aware that organized child abuse and trafficking is a reality, on the one hand. And on the other hand, the whole satanic panic thing has completely gone. Like, how many people are being falsely or convicted in any way at all of satanic ritual abuse? It's not happening, is it? There aren't allegations flying around about this thing. There isn't any kind of hysteria.
There are convictions about organized abuse, and yeah, some of those cases, I believe, do have some trappings of Satanism, but the you know, that isn't out there in the media as the primary thing. I believe the Jimmy Savile stuff in England and the Marc Dutroux one in Europe, I'm not sure quite where they are, had some satanic trappings involved. But I think people are realizing that it's not necessarily just Satanism. We have organized perpetrator groups, and some of those people are now getting caught. They put stuff on the internet, and thanks to the internet, they can be investigated more effectively than they used to be.
Yeah.
But no, we don't have any satanic panic going on. I think there are some vested interests who would want to make sure that that the satanic panic myth or the witch hunt narrative is resurrected. Mm. What happened was, I think, in the 90s, my experience in the early 90s as a therapist, I got my first clients who were talking about satanic ritual abuse, and it was a local group, and they were all members of the same group, and they corroborated one another's stories. Plus, I mean, I had my car followed by those people, you know, not my clients, but by members of the group. And there were, you know, there was plenty of evidence that something was going on that was real. And meanwhile, all these big, in the 90s, there were lawsuits against therapists, and some of the leaders in the field, like Bennett Braun, you know, got lawsuits. There were complaints to professional societies. There were just a lot of awful things going on to try and stop therapists who were talking about this, and they succeeded. They got people to be quiet at conferences, to not talk about it.
Hmm.
I think it was 94 when I first went to, and maybe it was earlier than that, when I first went to a conference of the International Society for the Study of Trauma and Dissociation. It was in Vancouver, BC that year. And so I went to it and was delighted that people were talking about the same things that I had experienced. The next year, I went to the same conference, it was in a different location, and discovered that nobody was talking about it except quietly in the hallways. There were no talks on the subject. Everybody had been silenced. Therapists had been silenced in talking about this because they were afraid of lawsuits and complaints and all of those things. And I think the same thing is happening now. And so therapists got silenced. And meanwhile, research continued and people discovered things. You know, there was a big study by Linda Meyer Williams looking at people who had forgotten their childhood abuse versus people who'd always remembered it, and discovering with validated abuse, people whose abuse had been validated by medical people right after it happened. And there was, you know, it showed that recovered memories were just as valid as always held memories. There were things like this going on, and the field was progressing with research. But meanwhile, everybody was quiet. And now the field has progressed a lot, and I would guess that the same vested interests who were behind the False Memory Syndrome Foundation are still active. They don't want anybody to believe that organized abuse happens, and particularly that there's any Satanist connections in that. So they're getting active again to try and silence us. You know, there's ISSTD Kills is written on a logo of the Gray Faction of the Satanic Temple. I mean, for goodness sake, ISSTD is a professional association of trauma therapists. It has 600 and something members. We have about 150 members in the ritual abuse and mind control and organized abuse special interest group. It's a lot of people. We are all licensed professionals. And we have, you know, it holds to very high standards. And, you know, to write ISSTD Kills, that's what I mean about the juvenile nature of these attacks. You don't just say that.
And who could they claim that the ISTD kills anyway if they were trying to back up that?
I don't know. Perhaps, I don't know, you know, survivors who take their own life, people who take their own life because they think they're a survivor. I have no idea. It's a ridiculous thing to say. But that's the level on which they operate. It's not like they have any actual expertise.
So, I mean, you suggested at the start that you felt you were going to look more into the Satanic Temple and that you were feeling galvanized by this. How do you feel that you would want to approach an organization like this?
I don't want to approach them. What I would like to do is, what I'm feeling is, what they did in the 90s, people like them, the Satanic Temple group didn't then exist, I believe, but what happened in the 90s was they got into the popular press, and they, through the use of the popular press, they made the general public believe that there was a witch hunt going on and innocent people are being accused of abuse and of Satanism. Mm-hmm. And they're getting in the popular press again. Therefore, we have the Gizmodo article and things like this. Mm-hmm. What we didn't do, what therapists did not do, and people who are knowledgeable did not do in the 90s, is we didn't get into the popular press. And since then, we got into, you know, we got into professional journals, people wrote articles, people did research. That has been done. But, you know, our thing is not to go into the popular press. We've never done that kind of thing before. You know, when you write for journals, you're very circumspect. You only state your limited conclusions. And research, of course, is always stymied by the fact that we're researching hidden groups who do not publicly acknowledge what they do. So it's like writing about the mafia in the 1930s or something, you know. But what I think we need to do is get our researchers, the people who do the research, the people who know more about it on an academic level, to do a little more with the popular press so that we can help the public discern properly. Because right now, I guess we have a false narrative that is being put out by these people. And I imagine that the Satanic Temple are not the only people who are going to be giving out that false narrative. And there are other groups in other countries, I believe. So I've been told by colleagues in other countries. But I'm not planning to do it all myself. I just want to be able to galvanize some of our researchers and people who know that stuff. Public statements.
It's exactly what I was hoping to achieve with this article, if I can get it into the Georgia Strait. That was very much my approach too, was just trying to get some reputable sources to go on record. So, I mean, I asked how you would approach the Grey Faction or the Satanic Temple. I didn't mean literally, although if I write this article, I will literally have to approach them, which is not a task that I relish. But I meant, how would you view them? but I'm from what you've just said, it maybe you're suggesting that it's not really necessary to focus on them at all, just to focus on establishing a counter narrative.
I think a counter narrative is really important. If there are people who have the ability to focus on them, I think that's a good idea. That's what Neil Brick has attempted to do so. But again, it's only on his website, which is probably preaching to the converted. I
Right.
think the counter narrative needs about them needs to get out into the popular press too.
Yeah, well, that's a hell of a hurdle, and as I'm sure you're aware, I mean, you just underline the fact that the people who are involved in researching and trying to understand and helping the victims of ritual abuse are not generally interested in getting word out in the mainstream media. So on the one hand, you've got that, but on the other hand, the mainstream media is generally not interested in these testimonies or these interpretations.
Well, perhaps it would be. I don't think people have tried. Therapists don't do that.
Well,
We
I've
don't talk
tried.
to media. We work with our clients in confidentiality. We can't even talk about what our clients have told us. When I write about what my clients have told me, I'm doing it years and years after those clients were around to tell me those things.
Yeah.
Survivors are speaking out, there's
But people, I mean, there's something inherent, there's a couple of things that come to mind. First of all, there's something inherently unpleasant about this information. So there's an inherent resistance in the public, quote unquote,
That's
to
true.
it. So they're already automatically inclined to want to disbelieve that. So if there's a narrative out there that says nothing to see here, it's all just mass hysteria, they're going to be temperamentally more attracted to that narrative. That's number one obstacle. The second one is that there actually is an awful lot out there, and an awful lot of people who are talking about satanic rituals and all the rest of it, but they're definitely not reputable. So whether it's Alex Jones or whether it's David Icke or countless other websites, some of which are valid, I mean, some of which are by survivors themselves, but I think survivors are often confused, obviously, by the trauma, but also they may have been implanted with false memories and false interpretations that are deliberately there to discredit their testimonies. So it's a very poisonous well. And because of that, the mainstream media, and I've been struggling with this for years, associates these narratives with something disreputable, something salacious, something sensationalist, something that's been discredited, and so on, or something right wing, right?
I think that's true, but like the sexual abuse in the Catholic Church receives plenty of publicity now. I was just listening to the radio this morning, and there was a presentation there on the current about the Catholic Church in BC and how many pre they were now releasing information about how many priests had been found guilty of credibly guilty of sexual abuse and what was done with those priests, and people want to know that kind of thing.
Yeah.
And this is really not any different. The satanic trappings are not that different. In fact, one of my first clients and somebody who wrote an important piece for my book was actually the way she got into therapy was because she was abused by a priest who happened to also be a member of the Satanist group. And so she started to remember more than what that priest had done to her. All these things are connected, and I think people are very interested in finding out about organized sexual abuse because really, the satanic stuff is part of organized sexual abuse, and it happens in institutions, it happens in schools, it happens in a lot of places. And this is only part of it. And if we put it in its proper context as part of organized abuse, and perhaps people are willing to listen and find this out.
Well, it's ironic that it's okay to talk about religious or Catholic abuse, and it's not okay to talk about satanic abuse, is there?
Yes, that's true. One thing I read was said that, oh, it's amazing. Satanists is the only religion here that don't abuse their kids.
Yeah. All right. And they're protected. They're more protected than Christians now because they're a minority. It's all got tangled up with identity politics.
Yes.
You identify as a Satanist, then you're this minority that somehow
Yes, true
needs
enough.
their rights need protecting. The other thing, though, is that Catholic sexual abuse, although I'm sure it's still going on, is seen as something in the past and something that belongs to these old, outdated patriarchal institutions that the mainstream dominant narrative is all about. Overthrowing that, whereas Satanism somehow has managed to coattail on identity politics as something new and progressive. And much more deeply, the problem is if you start to look at this organized child abuse, it's not going to be like with the Catholic Church. It's not contained by one institution. It's cross-institutional. It's in academia. It's in the military. It's in the government. It's in the entertainment industry.
That's right. Absolutely.
So that's a problem for people. It really is. Who wants to see that? It's like you can't send your kids to school anymore because you don't know.
Oh, I know. I mean, I feel the same way myself. And the news is all bad news. I get overwhelmed with the amount of bad news, and this is part of the bad news. I mean, maybe we don't even need to deal with this bad news because the whole environment is going to collapse in any case and the human race will be wiped out. And that's kind of how it feels nowadays. And yet, you have to shine the light in the dark places or they'll remain dark and more bad things will keep happening. And so we have to keep doing that.
Yeah, well, I'm certainly not suggesting not doing it, just the necessity for strategy based on, a better understanding of what people are able to receive, and including the mainstream media. I mean, talking about using the mainstream media to get the truth out. That may be, yeah.
I think this is true. I think, what did the Satanic Temple Grey Faction object to in my writings? I think there's two essential things. One is that I showed how organized perpetrator groups utilize children's capacity to dissociate to actually create structured personality systems. And I also showed how a therapist can work with these structured personality systems to undo all the training that they have given to these children. Because this is very sophisticated abuse. And I have talked about how sophisticated it is. And that is what these organized abuser groups don't want anybody to know, that there's a sophisticated abuse. It's not just some guy who likes to hurt little kids. It's very sophisticated. They teach one another how to do this, and they utilize dissociation. That's the one thing. Oh, I can't remember what the second thing was now that they object to in my writing. It'll come to me.
Exposing their private lives.
Yeah.
Well, it sparked something for me, which is, I mean, the other thing, obviously, that they're attacking you for is you're claiming that satanic, that the abuse of children has this satanic element,
Yes.
correlating those two things. And it occurs to me that because one of the ways that the satanic element is incorporated into this organized abuse, I believe, isn't just to terrorize the children, but also to discredit their memories, to make their memories seem unbelievable.
Yes, definitely.
And it's very
That's
effective.
right. That was my second point because I talk about the deception. In fact, many of the specific points in Evan Anderson's complaint about me are my points about deception, that people dress up in Satan suits to hurt little kids, for example. I am never saying Satan came and inhabited somebody and did these awful things and that children are possessed by the devil. Just the opposite. I am talking about human beings dressing up in costumes as part of of the abuse they do. It terrorizes the little kids and it makes the narrative seem unbelievable. This is what the abuser groups do not want people to know.
If I had no place to fall and I needed to, count on you to lay me down. I'll never tell you no lies. I don't believe it's wise. You got pretty eyes. Won't you spin me round? I'm not much of a lover, it's true. I'm here and I'm gone and I'm forever blue. But I'm sure wanting you. Sky full of silver and gold tries to hide the sun, but it can't. It's not for long. And if we help each other grow while the light of day smiles down our way, oh, we can't go wrong. But time, she's fast old train. She's here and she's gone and she won't come again. So won't you take my hand?
And there's a certain amount of cognitive dissonance. I mean, it's all cognitive dissonance, really, but specifically in what you're describing and trying to articulate around the sophisticated nature of the methods of mind control with the seemingly very unsophisticated procedure of dressing up in a devil suit and doing all this other bizarre stuff.
Yeah.
It's quite hard to reconcile those two. And on top of that, like I listened to both your, I listened to both the videos that they singled out, the Grey Faction, for their complaint. And I did find the first one, like I could see how they were able to use that, because I did find it hard to believe, even knowing you, even knowing what I know and all the research I've done and essentially believing that you know what you're talking about, I found it difficult to believe what you were talking about. That when I listened to the second one, where you talked specifically about how the brain gets rewired, mm-hmm. and you were talking you went into more time to actually describe how psychological fragmentation, dissociated identities are created, then I was able to understand that kind of, and so I was able to believe it. When you actually talk about somebody who's split off like this into these different compartments, even though in my own life I've discovered enough to know that it's possible, and even I think all over the place, you know, I think we all have it to one degree or another, because we don't understand consciousness, I still found it really, really hard to believe.
I can understand that. That's right. So maybe we need to be talking to the public more about how dissociation works. That's a really good point. And I think it must have been the one on working with the memories that goes more into how the dissociation works and how you bring the parts together to reduce the dissociation, which is interesting, because that one was originally a talk for therapists that I ended up having to give to survivors at the last minute because another speaker failed to show up for the conference. So I quickly modified it to give it to survivors, but they, that one goes more into more deep, more psychological detail about how that happens. Yeah, and all the tricks and the costumes and this kind of stuff are simply to reinforce the dissociation and to make, you know, make the parts of the child believe weird things, you know.
Well, it's theatre, isn't it?
It is theatre, yeah.
Yeah, because when we dissociate, we're going into a fantasy realm, and so then we're primed to believe a fantastic narrative. So it's as though, my sense anyway, it's as though the theatre is co-opting the dissociative strategy of the psyche by actually providing the fantasy images that otherwise we would create.
That's right. So then you have a little child who is drugged with drugs that will make them susceptible to suggestion, more and more susceptible to suggestion, and then the theater is happening to make the child believe it's being raped by a demon rather than a human being. There's drugs that you have a dissociated part of the child who has been hurt, who has been physically very badly traumatized. Yeah, it all kind of goes together to create something, and the theater is part of the sophistication of what goes on, yeah.
Hmm. So, I mean, there's an awful lot for people to take on who aren't familiar with this. You're talking about, you know, the public at large, whether it's mainstream media or whether it's putting a video on YouTube that anyone can see. And as we touched on at the beginning, when you're talking to survivors, it's an entirely different criteria, because the survivors, well, they don't need to be convinced of anything. On the contrary, right?
That's right.
They're already dealing with some reality that they don't fully understand. Perhaps they don't necessarily need to fully understand it either. They just want to be healed and become whole. So it's... it seems as though, I mean, I don't know if how you feel about those videos being online now, because it's, I mean, there are survivors obviously out there in the world who can benefit from them, but it does seem as though that kind of material is not only going to be incomprehensible to people who aren't survivors or don't have any memory of that, but also unbelievable.
That's right, and those were presentations at conferences for survivors, and I have been in contact with survivors who, you know, well, I'm thinking just recently contact with a survivor in Australia who found those videos very helpful, and with another woman who's married to a survivor and, you know, wants to know what to do with her husband, basically, because he, you know, he is a survivor and she doesn't know how to help him, and I had to try and help her find a therapist in her location.
Right.
Yeah, it's but no, the general public will not necessarily understand those things, just as, you know, what did the College of Psychologists have to do with that information? It was new information to them. So I guess we need to think about how we can make things understandable to the general public. I mean, everybody, you know, there's stuff that everybody has parts. Everybody has things that come up from their unconscious and they don't know where it came from. You know, to think that there are abuser groups who deliberately manipulate that reality and can do something to a child and know that they know how to make the child forget it. There are people that do that. Maybe the general public, I don't know, sorry. I'm talking to you.
I mean, I was going to ask you earlier if you thought that the Grey Faction were preempting something they felt was coming, which was a growing wave of awareness and testimonials around this. But even if it's not preempting, even where we're at currently, it's interesting to consider that organized child abuse is more and more recognized in the world,
Systematized,
high level as well. Number one. Number two, mind control and MKUltra has become more and more recognized and acknowledged. There's even that documentary Wormwood on HBO or one of the mainstream Netflix, whatever. I don't know if you saw that, but that was about Frank Olson, who's a victim of the CIA and MKUltra. Ewan Cameron in Canada, stuff about him's coming out, more and more becoming more and more known. And then number three, the trauma being stored in the body and the dissociative faculty of the of the psyche, and so on. All of that's also becoming more and more recognized. So really, what you're working with, if you combine all those three together, you've got to throw Satan in, unfortunately. then you've got what you're testifying to, you know, what you've experienced, no? But people aren't quite ready to put those things together.
I'm feeling like I should be taking notes right now so I can write an article, because you had to, yeah, send it to me. Yeah.
Well, we're recording this, so yeah, it's all on record. But my point is that people are being prepared for an understanding of this, but if you try and take them to it too quickly, then they will panic, and they'll get confused, and they will think it's incredible. And in a certain sense, I just wrote this for my book, people are right to disbelieve something they don't understand, because if you don't understand it, believing it's not going to be helpful.
No, I think that's right. I mean, I didn't believe it when I was first working with my first clients. I just thought it was some kind of fad that came out of California. I really didn't believe that any of this stuff could be real. You know, my psychological training as a grad student was very sort of hard science, experimental type of thing. And this stuff made no sense to me. But what I've always had is a big drive to understand how things work. And so when I went into it, I thought, I've got to figure out how this stuff works. How does it work? What do they do? How do they split the mind? How does it happen that people become this way? And I gained some understanding, and that's what I wrote about. So it just needs to be written about, I guess, maybe for the general public a little more, so they can see how it works. And, you know, we have these films like the Jason Bourne things and that kind of stuff, mm-hmm. you know. But there's in general, even though we have those things, I mean, Jason Bourne goes in there as an adult, and somehow they do something to him, and then he ends up with having these different personalities who can do different things. But, you know, what we know is this has to be done on children to really produce the dissociation that is needed to create different personas within a human being.
Yeah. Yeah, which is just a whole other can of worms. And again, it's just so gruesome and unpleasant that you certainly wouldn't make a Hollywood entertainment out of it. And yes. People just don't want to think about it. And I don't think that the films like The Bourne Identity, or even more, you know, serious films, nothing's coming to mind offhand, but Manchurian Candidate, say, I don't think they necessarily help, because I think when we're talking about compartmentalization and fragmentation, we can also extend that to the collective as well. Like the collective mind has a tendency to compartmentalize too, and I think that when people associate these things with Hollywood fiction and fantasy, that's a problem too.
I think that's right, and I think Hollywood, you know, when I look at what's on television nowadays, I mean, you know, you can't turn on the TV without there being a gunshot or an explosion. Constantly, the way in which the public is being lured into thinking that violence is a normal way of being, and that it is exciting and everybody wants to be part of this. There's this manipulation of the media going on, which is kind of scary to me. I mean, I choose my shows that I watch, and I don't watch other stuff, but, you know, but the ads that come onto the shows that I watch, there's one right now called Evil, which is a new one that I've seen tiny bits of in ads. And, you know, it's basically about, it's about ritual stuff, implying that people actually are possessed by Satan or demons or whatever, and therefore they can commit horrible crimes, making it all part of the supernatural genre, like vampires and things like this, or zombies or whatever it is, making it seem like it's all fiction. Meanwhile, there's actual real stuff that is done by deliberate mind controllers. And the information that goes out about MKUltra says, oh, well, it all ended many years ago, so it's fine. Nobody does that anymore. Yeah, I don't believe that. I'm sure it's still going on. Research into how mind control work started with Mengele, and it's gone on since Mengele in various directions by various groups.
Well, I think there's a sort of general unformed or uninformed perspective that it didn't quite work, you know, so
Yeah.
they abandoned it. But on the other hand, in the fictions, there's a growing trend to reframe mind control as a positive thing. So if you think about the superheroes,
Yes.
many of those are created, like Jason Bourne, through trauma and mind control and programming and technology and so on. And that's what everyone wants to be now, as a superhero.
True. And then you have the little kids watching movies about superheroes who are basically invulnerable. So everyone wants to be invulnerable, don't they? Because it's a scary world. Ugh.
Yeah, particularly if you've been traumatized.
Yes.
Yeah. Well, bring it then to the big picture, that, as I say, there's survivor testimonies and experiences and the therapists who know what's going on. There's these fictionalized narratives that don't help. You know, they just glorify it or glamorize it or demonize it or make it all supernatural. There's the people who actually know what's going on because they're committing it and they're busy dissembling and manipulating and distorting and all the rest of it. And then there's a whole particularly internet-powered narrative about Illuminati mind control. And even though, and I'm working on this in my most recent book, which is about Hollywood, really, but I also get into, you know, larger conspiracy theories. Even though I think there's a lot of correspondence points between this paranoid worldview, whether or not it includes reptilians or Satanists, but about, you know, Illuminati controlling the world through various different methods. Even though I think there's a lot of points of correspondence with what the reality, I think that that's also a form of massive disinformation. And I think it works precisely because it allows people to believe something without understanding it, number one, and number two, because it creates a very close counterfeit for what's really going on, so that people who are trying to find out what's going on or do have a sense, they end up getting lured into this counterfeit narrative, which more or less fits, but it's being controlled also.
What is that narrative? Can you state it succinctly so I can understand what...
There's a secret elite that rule the world, that they're Satanists, that they sexually abuse children, they mind control. I mean, everything I say, you're probably going to say, oh, well, that's probably true.
Yeah, that's why I'm asking.
But that's my point. Like the differences are in the nuance, but they're so key. They're so absolutely key. I'll bring it to the specifics and also why I'm bringing this up. Otherwise, you know, I might confuse you too much, or myself for that matter. But so for this article for Georgia Strait, I'm pitching to somebody there. This, you know, hopefully by the time this goes public, I'll either be accepted or it won't. So this won't influence the outcome there. I shared the proposal that I sent to you also, and he thought it was good. But he also said there's a possible problem. He'd looked up your latest book. Is it called In the Trenches?
From the Trenches, yes.
From the Trenches. He says Alison Miller refers to Illuminatis and Nazis controlling stuff. He said that's going to kill it right out the gate. If they see that at Georgia Strait, that's it. It'll be dead before it even gets out the starting gate.
Well, it isn't actually me who talks about Illuminatis and Nazis. It's Wendy Hoffman, my co-author.
Yeah.
She was my client, and she does. That is exactly what she talks about, that those are the primary groups by whom she was abused, by a group that she identifies as the Illuminati, though she says it goes by many names, and another group which she identifies as Nazis, who also, you know, even if they exist as one group, it's basically far right wing people. Yeah, and that those are the primary groups that seem to be operating at the level of political and entertainment leadership. Mm-hmm. I have no way of knowing whether that's true. What I do know is that as Wendy worked with her memories Those are what came up for her. She isn't a big reader. She doesn't read all that. I mean, she's a reader, but she reads, you know, high quality fiction. She doesn't read this kind of stuff. This is what came up from her memories of what happened to her as she struggled to integrate herself. And so all I have is her words for what she believes is going on. I don't know whether it's true. I wouldn't have believed it until Wendy became my client and I hear what she's talking about. And now I certainly, it seems like a possibility that these are some of the important groups that are doing this. I'm sure they're not the only ones. I imagine, you know, that Mossad and the Russian intelligence service, to say nothing of, you know, subgroups within the CIA or whatever, are all involved in doing things too. There's more than just two groups. But sure. Maybe those groups do exist.
Maybe they do. I mean, I spoke to Wendy, of course, too. I also stumbled over that at the time. And you might remember that I tried to get our interview on the New Books Network, which is a more mainstream thing, and I got into an argument with the guy and ended up having to quit working with them precisely because of her claims, specifically about Joseph Mengele. Now, I don't know how accurate Wendy's claims are, obviously, but I also don't know how much she can know for sure. I think to go back to my original point, it's that, leaving aside for a moment whether or not Wendy has accurate memory or whether those memories themselves were part of some theatre, the fact that mentioning those things is a way to discredit her testimony or your testimony right out the gate suggests that that's also being used in the same way that the satanic imagery is being used.
Oh, I think that may very well be. You know, you take these websites, David Icke, the lizard stuff, you know, they say all this stuff that a number of survivors are reporting happened, you know, in terms of dissociation and abuse. And suddenly, at the head of this all, there are these lizard aliens or whatever the heck they are. I started reading this and thought, this is completely absurd. I'm sorry, my tolerance for the ridiculous stops here. You know, we don't have lizards. So, I mean, the best lie is a lie that contains some truth. So if you can put out that kind of lie, you can make everyone think that this is all nonsense. Maybe there is such a group as the Illuminati or whatever they are, who don't call themselves the Illuminati anymore, though maybe they did 200 years ago. But any narrative about them, Springmeier springs to mind, you know, contains elements of such absurdity that then I sort of think, what the heck can I believe?
Yeah,
I don't know. What I do know is the way Wendy got at her memories, and she wasn't getting at her memories in any kind of logical way. She was sitting there putting herself in a kind of trance situation where she's talking to her inside personas, younger ones, and then she's speaking out a verbatim transcript of something that happened, like she's describing the scene, and she's narrating the conversation that's happening between two abusers. You know, she's not making it up like you would write a story. It's just coming out of her as, you know, as like a recording of something that happened to her. And I don't think anybody could do this with conscious intent.
Yes. So putting that aside then, and that's something you have direct experience of, how she's accessed the memories and your trust that she's being truthful in that process. Have you considered, I'm sure you have, and maybe we talked about this last time, and I think I maybe talked about it with Wendy, that some of those memories, even if they are real memories, might be of staged events that were staged partially in order that she would discredit herself when she recounted them.
Oh, absolutely. There's all kinds of those things. For example, identities. And when we worked with a memory, we would look for the tricks and for the deceptions. For example, there was one situation where she was remembering being taken into a building and up some stairs, and there was veiled Muslim looking woman there, taking her in and out of the building. And then there were a bunch of people, and she's being led to believe that she's being abused by a bunch of Islamic terrorists.
Mm.
And so as we're talking about it, I said, can you see their hands? Their hands were white.
Mm.
No, they were not Islamic terrorists. Things like this. And there are things where, you know, we go through the memory, and then I say, okay, what, this memory seems to have some specific identities in it. Was anything done to you after this part of the memory that you just processed to confuse you about identity? And then she would go into another memory about how they confused her about identity, how they would tell her that this person was so-and-so and that person was so-and-so. There was a whole bunch of training for identity confusion. So those are part of the memories we worked through, was the identity confusion training. It was all very interesting. A lot of stuff like this. I don't think she's really put that into her memoirs, but maybe she should, you know, because it was very important.
That after.
I think again it depends who who we're trying to communicate with. Now, my focus has always been on the mainstream, even though I have not succeeded in penetrating it, for, you know, probably reasons to do with my own conditioning, if not programming, like a desperate need to actually be successful and so on. But be that as it may, my focus is on that. And so I'm as aware as I can be about what's going to fly here. I'm not saying I've done it well. Obviously, I haven't. But so if Wendy or you are writing books or doing presentations for other survivors, then that's, as we've already discussed, that's an entirely different criteria than if you're hoping that this will, you know, pass the acid test of the skeptical mind that's out there. Yeah.
Yeah. It's ironic, isn't it? Because I've always been a skeptic, you know, in a whole lot of ways. Yeah.
It's ironic, yeah. But of course, you've been immersed in this world, so you might have lost touch in a necessary way with what is credible or incredible to other people to some degree.
Perhaps.
Like you mentioned the lizards as being absurd. Well, to many people, they're not, needless to say. I actually don't find lizard people more absurd than the Illuminati. It's not that I find either absurd. Again, it's the association. It's how these things are being talked about, and then they become tainted by association. So there's been so many people talking about the Illuminati now in such a way that is just not grounded. It's not well thought through. It's not backed up with citations. It's just,
well, that's interesting. I haven't even seen that conversation. Where does it occur?
The Illuminati conversation.
Yeah.
Oh, well, so there you go. So it's also a lack of familiarity with what's out there, with the sort of darker alleys of the internet and so on. Just Google the Illuminati and put aside an afternoon, particularly on YouTube, and you'll, I mean, I don't recommend it except as necessary research, but you would have to suffer through dozens of videos by people pretending to be researchers with no skills whatsoever, really, but just a lot of enthusiasm and a lot of unhealthy belief based on, you know, third, fourth hand sources, you know, zero academic credentials. Not that those necessarily mean much these days, but there's nothing really grounded there. It's just recycling.
Oh, that's very interesting. So yes, there's not just the propaganda that bad things don't happen to kids and kids don't forget what happened to them. There's also another propaganda which says that there are very weird and peculiar and completely unbelievable things happening all the time.
Yeah.
And so anyone trying to understand it has to make their way between those two sets of propaganda, which may well be put out by the same people.
That's right, and they reinforce each other, because if you start thinking, wait, things aren't quite what they're telling us they are, the way they are, and you start looking, and then you end up with David Icke or Alex Jones, you're just like, you know, a visceral reaction repels you, so you scuttle back to the mainstream narrative as if there was no more nuanced middle ground, because that's all been successfully filtered out by the algorithms and marginalized. And it's also, I mean, I think there's a way to understand this in terms of how the psyche fragments as well, because like you're saying about that child who's traumatized, and so he has to split off, and when he goes to school, he's in an alter or personality that has no memory of it. That's the mainstream narrative, essentially, where everything is more or less okay. Yes, there's lots of problems with the patriarchy and all that, but you know, it's still more or less fixable, and it's more or less the way it seems. But because we've split off the awareness of what's really going on in order to believe that, there's this deeper, dark awareness pulling on us to try and heal and integrate. And that, the tendency is then we will get, because we respond to that, we'll get lured into these other this other narrative, which supposes or presumes to answer what's going on, to tell us what's going on. It's a honeypot, like the internet's full of them.
Yeah, and that trap is there, not just for everybody, but specifically for survivors who begin to remember things, I guess.
Yeah, exactly.
Then they get into that honeypot and they start to, believe all kinds of bizarre things. And I'm sure that, you know, 20, 30 years ago, they were already being set up to believe those bizarre things, which were then going to become that that online narrative. You know?
So they co-create it. That's the worst part of all. They end up co-creating it. That was what Prisoner Infinity was about, the Whitley Strieber and the alien, because he was the main proponent of the alien abduction narrative, the most famous one. And he was very successful, and he had a website. He has a website, Undiscovered Country, where many survivors went to.
Who is this?
Whitley Strieber.
Oh, Strieber, right, okay. Because I have read some of his books. Yes, right. I see.
And they went there, and then, of course, he was telling them that he was affirming or validating their screen memory, if they were screen memories of alien abductions, while at the same time identifying, I'm not saying he was doing this himself, I think he was also fragmented and controlled.
Yes.
But it has this double function. It co-opts the awakening or the healing of the survivors, but it also recruits them and creates an audience base to help generate that counterfeit narrative.
Yes, and recruits them into believing the counterfeit narrative and never getting at the real stuff.
So I think we have a whole culture that's essentially that at this point.
Talking conspiracy theory, aren't we? Jeez.
Yes, but it's not. That's the thing. The conspiracy theory is also a false narrative.
I know. If you call something a conspiracy theory, that automatically implies that it's false. Yeah.
Well, it discredits you on the one hand, or it gives you an audience base that you don't necessarily want because they're right, they're alt-right, or they're, you know, I mean, in a certain sense, you do want them because there'll be many survivors there and there'll be people who are open. But on the other hand, they've been polluted with all this other stuff, and so they're going to automatically put whatever you're giving them into the context that's been created, this false context of conspiracy theory. Well, it's not conspiracy so much as complicity, because we're all being traumatized and split off, and so we're all working against ourselves in that regard. So it's more of an internal, I see it more of an internal colonization that's occurring. There are conspiracies that, you know, to bring about this colonization, but the big conspiracy is one that we're all involved in, we're all complicit with.
We are, that's right. It's a wonderful world, and it's getting better day after day after day. And if we all recycle all of our garbage, then the world's not going to have a problem.
Like global warming is the big problem.
Exactly. Well, it is a big problem, but that's another place where, you know, the narrative is being put out by oil companies, et cetera, suggesting that really, you know, consuming all these fossil fuels isn't really a problem. And science is going to find ways to get the plastic out of the oceans and it'll all be fine. You know, we're getting all kinds of false narratives in that area too, to lull us into complicity and complacency. We've done our little bit, everybody do your little bit and everything will be fine. Just don't look at the big problem. Don't change society. And these refugees, you know, we're going to have climate refugees in a few years, and then what's going to happen about them? We're already preparing to get rid of traumatized refugees, and now so we'll be ready when the climate refugees appear.
I don't know about that. I mean, I try to only focus on the big problems that correspond directly with my own little problems, if you know what I mean.
Yes, I know what you mean, sure, and I've worked on it. That's true. I've worked in
But the climate's fine where I am, and the air's beautiful as where you are as well. We don't have a problem with immigration. Homophobia is not a problem, etc., etc. So I tend to ignore an awful lot of what I see as straw man problems, even though they might be real for other people. But the problem of mind control is, I think, indisputably one that affects all of us.
It is a major, major problem. That's right. And I have to keep reminding myself, because everybody where I live focuses on the climate problem, and it is important, but mind control and where it has permeated our society and produce so many false narratives. And when you're looking at all the political polarization right now that's happening all over the world, particularly the Western world, you sort of think, okay, how much does the mind control that's gone on, to what extent has that created this political polarization deliberately?
Yeah.
That's what it's trying to do. When you hear that the Russian trolls are, you know, what they do on the internet is a lot of their messages on, say, Facebook and things like this, the purpose is not to put forward a particular viewpoint, it's to create conflict, to create opposite things, so that, you know, pro-vaccines, anti-vaccines, whatever the topic is, it's supposed to polarize people.
Yeah.
It's like everybody get in conflict with one another.
Yeah, that was a method, I discovered that recently. It's called schismogenesis, and it was developed by Gregory Bateson when he was working
Bateson.
For OSS.
He worked for OSS, did he?
He did, yeah, when he was in the early days of anthropology, and Margaret Mead, of course, was his wife. So that goes pretty far back. I'd be careful about any Russian troll memes, though, because I think that's part of the false narratives being created.
Another false narrative.
It could be,
I don't know. This is what I have heard about Russian trolls. How do I know what's true?
Yeah, well, because one of the effects that's having, demonizing the Russians all over again, is people are more and more believing in the CIA as a positive force, which who would have thought that could ever happen?
Yeah, that's right.
Because we need the CIA again to protect us from the Russians. So yeah. I tend to look at what's the result of this narrative to gauge how likely I am to believe it. Because if it clearly has an effect on the collective, you can think, well, that's a useful narrative. So I that's probably not an accurate one.
How do you find accurate narratives? I mean, I know what I have heard from people who have lived it.
Yeah.
I do not discount something that comes from someone who has lived it. You know, that's my information source. People who've lived through things. In the stuff that I've written about, because these are not sophisticated people making up stories. These are people who went through stuff.
Well, that's right. And there is there's one card that you can play if you play it right, which is that in our current climate, even though this has also been abused, the testimony of victims is kind of sacrosanct. Like you're not supposed to say anything to discredit or to devalue or to, to silence testimonials of victims. Like our culture has become more and more about raising up the victims and the rights of the victims.
And that's only recent. It didn't used to be like that. You know?
Yeah, and it's not a good thing is the thing. It's being used, it's been weaponized because, you've got these terrible abuses of power. I don't know how much you followed them, but I won't mention specifics because we'll get pulled off Swain. But it's a kind of narcissistic abuse of the victim card. Like I say, even the Satanic Temple was kind of, I think that's part of the reason they identified as Satanists, because they can frame a Satanist as a victim of patriarchal oppression.
Yeah, that's true.
But there is still this attitude whereby if you emphasize the fact that these are people, something terrible has happened to them, and they're trying to express it, they're trying to communicate, and they're trying to heal.
Yeah.
It may not be entirely accurate. We don't know exactly, what it is that happened to them that they're trying to express. I think that's a way to neutralize some of the, it's not going to neutralize the absolute trolls, because you say they're like 10-year-olds, like malignant 10-year-olds.
Yeah.
But a lot of trolling, or almost most of it, is for the audience. It's for the public.
Yeah.
Essentially.
That's right. If the public is actually there to listen to it, because I felt on those websites where I saw them, they were just preaching to the converted themselves from their viewpoint.
But they want it to look like that. Like at the Gizmodo thing, I wasn't able to comment. I don't know if that was deliberate, but I tried everything, and technically I couldn't get past their filters. Yeah. But it looks there like almost everybody's on board with the Gizmodo grey faction agenda. But of course, that's how they want it to look, because then anyone who has a different point of view is going to be intimidated
Well,
about.
that's right. I decided not to comment because when I looked at the comments, they were all the same. And I thought, you know, for all I know, the same person wrote all the comments. That's how
Right.
they looked. Yeah.
Exactly, exactly. But then there are people reading it who do feel differently. I mean, one of the first comments is, I'm a survivor of mind control, actually. So somehow that's right near the top. But yeah, if they can make it look like that, then yeah, people are just discouraged, and then that will be true, that no one will comment who doesn't agree.
And meanwhile, what you said about the voice of the victim, you know, that's still valid. I mean, and therapists are the ones who get the stories. And when I hear a victim, you know, somebody who was a child, and they're describing what happened to them in, you know, often in childish language, and there's no sophistication to it. There's no pre-planning. There's nothing like that. And, you know, yes, they could have been deceived, but they could have been deceived about what was actually going on. But it's very clear that something went on that was very malignant. And, you know, if they were being deceived, that only makes it more sophisticated abuse, not less sophisticated. And so, you know, having heard that, it's valid when you hear that. It's not like some adult recite, you know, you hear some supposed survivors of things, and it sounds like they've told their story 100 times and they've polished it and things like this. And that's not what therapists hear. We hear people who are actually right in the throes of something that happened to them. And you know, we can't just say, oh, well, that may or may not be true. I don't believe you, and I don't disbelieve you.
Mm-hmm.
That's recommended to some of us. That's just absurd.
No, well, it's not really necessary to take a position there. I mean,
no.
I think that's a false dichotomy we've got, you know, been brainwashed into taking, that if you either believe or disbelieve, well, actually, you can just...
No, I think that's right. But we don't have to say we neither believe nor disbelieve either. We have to say, you know, I understand. That,
yeah.
You know, just tell me what happened to you. I'm here to hear you. And it's up to you to decide what it is.
Well, the space of not disbelieving is a big space, actually, for survivors, I think, because they're so used to being disbelieved.
That's right. Yeah, but there can be. It's so much isn't how you say it, you know, because you can express disbelief non-verbally.
Mm.
There's so many ways to express disbelief while you're not saying that you disbelieve, but. People know, you know, you can tell whether, most survivors can tell whether or not a person's receptive to what they might be about to talk about that they've now decided not to talk about. Thank you very much.
Yeah, it's being receptive, as you say. So it's not necessarily even disbelieving, but just not wanting to hear it.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, because we're afraid of it.
Yeah.
It's a very scary thing to think that these things go on.
I think that's the number one problem, as I say, is that people, they don't want to hear it and they don't want to believe it because it's so awful. And there's absolutely no way to change the latter. It's as awful as it is. In fact, it's worse than most of us can imagine.
That's true.
So you can't change that. As far as people being receptive, that's very difficult to change too. You can't really change other people. So I think all that leaves is the way in which we try and convey what it is that we have to convey,
mm-hmm.
and that's so where the strategy comes in. Yeah,
that's interesting, and you have some really good points for me about strategy, which I'd like to hear more of. And I have one point for you about strategy. You're so intelligent that you put things in very sophisticated language. Somewhere along the line, you've got to dumb it down.
Never. I'll never do it. I'm trying. I'm working really hard on this book proposal. I can't dumb the book down because it's written, but at least the proposal.
Yeah.
Not dumb it down. No, I don't. I actually don't agree that I need to dumb it down.
It's
but
simplify the language and the explanations so the general public can understand. Yeah.
Yeah, and make it more appealing. Somehow, like, but we have to persuade people, if that's the word, or at least invite people to want to know this.
Yes.
Because the nature of it is who the hell would want to know unless you have to? And yet, as you say, people are fascinated by organized abuse. They're fascinated by depravities and aberrations. They watch, you know, media that makes it entertaining, for God's sake. So there is a way to somehow sort of co-opt that part of people in a good way.
I think so. And people want to keep themselves safe. And part of keeping yourself safe is knowing what you have to keep safe from, you know, just like, you know, what do you do if you're walking somewhere where there may be bears? You know, you need to learn that. Well, this is similar.
Right.
How do you raise your children so that they are free from some of these things? Everybody wants to know things that will help them keep safe and make society safer.
Yeah, which is central to knowing these things. I mean, it really wouldn't be worth knowing them if it wasn't somehow going to help us to become whole and navigate our lives. And this is true even if we're not survivors personally. We're all being affected by it, I think.
Well, we are. And those of us who have children or grandchildren, our children or our grandchildren could be affected. Well, unless we understand and know properly how to protect them. I mean, you remember all that stuff that used to happen about, you know, I mean, parents still drive their kids one block to the school, you know, because they're afraid of the old, you know, the person that could abduct them and put them in the car. That was the narrative when the real offender was the uncle, you know. The person you have to be afraid of is the family members, not that. We have false narratives about where the risk really is, and we have to get out a true narrative, and people want to know where the risk really is.
As long as there's the sense that there's something they can do about it, I think.
That's true. And there's too much, there's so much despair that there's a lot of people. Maybe that's big part of the problem. People do not want to know something that just seems unmanageable.
Yeah, which can be the case if there's domestic abuse, if there's abuse possibly going on in the school, your child isn't safe at home or at school.
Yeah.
What do? You turn a blind eye just so that you can carry on functioning. And nobody would do that consciously. Well, I don't know about nobody. Of course, there's some terrible people out there, but I think a lot of people do it unconsciously.
Oh, I think so. And I think the world is more aware now of domestic abuse. Teachers are more aware that kids could be abused at home and they watch for it. There's things like that. I don't know how investigations are conducted, but I hope they do not tell the parents what the child has disclosed and ask the child to disclose in the presence of the parents. I don't know what happens, but that's what used to happen. And then, of course, it was, you know, the child couldn't talk in the presence of people who were going to punish them severely for talking. I think society has progressed somewhat beyond that. And same thing with the domestic partner abuse, you know. So there are some things being put into place to make it safe.
It's tricky, isn't it? Because the child protection services are not necessary. I mean, they often interfere in ways that aren't ethical also, and they could also be fronts for abusive organizations.
That's right.
It's a slight change of track, but I wanted to mention it. Did you follow the Jeffrey Epstein stories at all?
To some extent, yes. Yeah.
Because I think that's an example. I mean, with Virginia Roberts being a sex slave, not that young an age, but she also was abused as a child. I haven't looked into it, but it seems as though that's an example of something that is out there in the mainstream media, so everybody knows about it, which is very close. It correlates very closely with the kind of things that survivors are testifying to.
Well, the Epstein case, yes, and then you look at his associates. One of them, you know, has been mentioned to me by a client.
Right.
You know? Yeah, actually more than one of them. Come to think of it, and I'm thinking, I already knew about these people. That's interesting.
Yeah,
I didn't know it would ever come to public light.
So I think, I mean, my impression more talking to you is that the Grey Faction, to bring it back to that can of worms, it's a kind of paper tiger. I think that they're attempting and somewhat successful at creating an appearance that they have more credibility than they have, that they have more sway than they have, and that the people are actually on board with what they're saying. Actually, their arguments and their position is very tenuous, I think, and very easy to discredit. I doubt that they would talk to me, even if I was willing to talk to them, but maybe they would. But I mean, for example, if one ever did get in a debate with them about these things, there are so many factual case studies, so much evidence one could just present to them with a question mark that would neutralize what they're saying. As in, you're saying this is ridiculous and absurd. Well, what about Jeffrey Epstein and Virginia Roberts, you know? Or what about Jimmy Savile? Or what about what we know about, you know, organized child trafficking and the pedophilia in the Pentagon? I mean, just so many different case studies.
You can't present it to them because you know what they're going to say, because they're a lobbying group, you know? They have a particular agenda. They're not going to listen.
Right, but that would expose the agenda is what I'm saying. Because if they don't have an argument, they can't say, oh, that's all mass hysteria about Jeffrey Epstein.
No, that's right.
Right?
Yeah.
So
yeah, right.
It actually isn't mass hysteria, that's the thing.
Yeah,
it's smoke and mirrors. They're using smoke and mirrors.
They are using smoke and mirrors, that's right. And they don't have any credibility as experts in the field of recovered memory or anything like that. They don't know a thing about it. So, yeah.
Changes in the heart. Change with the times, strangers in the night, as up and downtown, changes in your soul, they happen all the time.
And that's the end of the podcast for another week. I'm Jason Horsley at The Liminalist, the podcast between at horticulture.com. If you want to support this podcast, please do so by donating and or buying, reviewing my recent books. Next week's podcast will be with Recluse from Visor. Stars change with the night, strangers in the heart stay on.